Recorded Books and One Click Digital present Lincoln, Disc 18.
Support for the president, which appeared so overwhelming immediately after Bull Run, rapidly eroded. For many Democrats, the defeat brought realization that the nation faced a long and costly war. Those who were styled war Democrats rallied behind the president. A larger group of Democrats reluctantly accepted the war as long as it was fought to preserve the Constitution as it is and the Union as it was. But they were nervous lest a prolonged conflict prove the Trojan horse of tyranny. A few, like James A. Bayard of Delaware and Clement L. Vallandigham of Ohio, willingly acknowledged that they were peace Democrats. Bayard took as his motto, "Anything is better than a fruitless, hopeless, unnatural civil war." These divisions deeply troubled Lincoln. He recognized what he called the plain facts of his situation. The Republicans, as he said, came into power very largely in a minority of the popular vote. His administration couldn't possibly put down the rebellion without assistance from the Democrats. It was, he observed, mere nonsense to suppose a minority could put down a majority in rebellion. Consequently, he carefully cultivated war Democrats in Congress, like Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, the only Southern senator who refused to follow his state when it seceded, and Reverdy Johnston of Maryland, who sustained the president's use of war powers and refuted the arguments of Chief Justice Taney. He rewarded Joseph Holt, the staunch Kentucky Unionist, who'd been Secretary of War under Buchanan, by naming him Judge Advocate General. In making military appointments, he tried to select commanders on the basis of military expertise rather than on what he called political affinity, and a sizable number of the generals he selected were Democrats: George B. McClellan, Benjamin F. Butler, W.S. Rosecrans, John A. McClernand, and many others. In policy, too, he tried to build a broad base of support by presenting the issue before the country as one of union versus disunion. In attempting to build a consensus, the president ran the risk of dividing his own party. Many Republicans felt that he was neglecting the moral and political arguments against slavery that had been the foundation of their party's ideology. 2 days after the defeat at Bull Run, Senator Zachariah Chandler of Michigan and Senator Sumner, accompanied by Vice President Hamlin, came to the White House and urged the president to make the war a contest between freedom and slavery. Sumner argued that emancipation was a military necessity, and Chandler asked Lincoln to free the slaves in order to create such chaos in the South that the Confederacy would collapse. The president listened politely, but said such measures were too far in advance of public opinion. Among disgruntled Republicans, the feeling spread that Lincoln, though well-meaning, was slow and incompetent. In his diary, Count Adam Gorofsky, the eccentric Polish nobleman who worked as a translator for the State Department, accurately captured the mood of Republicans in Congress. "Mr. Lincoln, in some way, has a slender historical resemblance to Louis XVI. Similar goodness, honesty, good intentions, but the size of events seems to be too much for him." According to Gorofsky, Senator Wade was so disgusted with the slowness and inanity of the administration that he remarked, "I do not wonder that people desert to Jeff Davis, as he shows brains. I may desert myself." to express that dissatisfaction and to give some direction to the Union war effort, the Congress, just before adjournment, passed the Confiscation Act, which provided that a master would lose ownership of any slave employed to assist the Confederate armies. Lincoln signed the measure reluctantly, and it had little effect except as an expression of opinion. In late August, the diffuse feeling of unhappiness with the Lincoln administration found a focus. General John C. Fremont, named commander of the Department of the West, with headquarters in St. Louis, took drastic steps to defeat a Confederate invasion in southwestern Missouri and end widespread guerrilla warfare elsewhere. Proclaiming martial law in the entire state of Missouri, Fremont announced that civilians bearing arms would be tried by court-martial and shot if convicted, and that slaves of persons who aided the rebellion would be emancipated. Fremont's proclamation, issued without consultation with Washington, clearly ran counter to the policy Lincoln had announced in his inaugural address of not interfering with slavery and against the recently adopted Crittenden resolution pledging that restoration of the Union was the only aim of the war. It also violated the provisions of the Confiscation Act, which established judicial proceedings to seize slaves used to help the rebel army. Lincoln saw at once that Fremont's order must be modified. He directed the general to withdraw his threat to shoot captured civilians bearing arms. "Should you shoot a man according to the proclamation, the Confederates would very certainly shoot our best man in their hands in retaliation," he admonished Fremont. "And so, man for man indefinitely." The president viewed Fremont's order to liberate slaves of traitorous owners as even more dangerous. "Such action," he reminded the general, "will alarm our Southern Union friends and turn them against us, perhaps ruin our rather fair prospect for Kentucky." He asked Fremont to modify his proclamation. Though Lincoln said he was writing in a spirit of caution and not of censure, Fremont took his letter as an undeserved rebuke. He, after all, was on the scene. He had to deal with the vindictiveness of Confederate sympathizers in Missouri. He had to defend the state when Washington conspicuously neglected to provide the men, the equipment, and even the food he needed to sustain his army. Very angry, he permitted his redoubtable wife Jessie, the daughter of the celebrated Missouri Senator Thomas Hart Benton, to go to Washington and present his case in person to the president. Mrs. Fremont arrived on September 10th and immediately asked the president to set a time for an interview. He replied tersely, "Now, at once." Though it was 9 o'clock in the evening, and she was tired and dusty from traveling all day, she went immediately to the White House. She didn't find Lincoln hospitable. He received her in the Red Room, standing, and he didn't offer her a seat. When she presented a letter from her husband explaining his position, Lincoln, as she remembered it, smiled with an expression that was not agreeable, and read it without comment. Attempting to make Fremont's views clearer, she went on to talk about the need to strike a blow against slavery that would enlist British sentiment on the Union side. The president cut her off with, "You're quite a female politician." Then, in a voice that she found both hard and repelling, he told her, "It was a war for a great national idea, the Union, and General Fremont shouldn't have dragged the Negro into it." The next day, the president, taking note of Fremont's unwillingness to modify his proclamation on his own, very cheerfully ordered him to change it so as to conform to and not to transcend the provisions of the Confiscation Act. Some of Lincoln's advisers feared that Fremont would disobey the president's order and set up on his own. But Lincoln wouldn't permit civilian authority to be overruled by the military, and he wouldn't allow sensitive questions concerning slavery and emancipation to be decided by anyone but the president himself. That was not the end of the Fremont problem. The general, who'd made his reputation as a pathmaker of the western trails to California, was never able to find his way across the Missouri political terrain. He quarreled with everybody. He scorned the duly elected, if ineffectual, governor of Missouri, Hamilton R. Gamble, who promptly went to Washington with complaints about military incompetence in St. Louis. He quarreled with his subordinates. He made the serious mistake of quarreling with the Blair family, which had originally sponsored his appointment as commander of the Department of the West, and eventually he even ordered the arrest of Frank Blair. He's losing the confidence of men near him whose support any man in his position must have to be successful, Lincoln observed. His cardinal mistake is that he isolates himself and allows nobody to see him, and by which he doesn't know what's going on in the very matter he's dealing with. To ineptness, charges of fraud and corruption in the Department of the West were added. Though nobody accused Fremont of using his command for personal gain, the Blairs exerted incessant pressure on the president to remove the general. But Lincoln was always reluctant to dismiss subordinates, however incompetent, and told Montgomery Blair that it wasn't quite fair to squander Fremont until he has another chance. The very negative report that the adjutant general, Lorenzo Thomas, submitted in October decided the issue. Fremont was relieved from command on November 2nd. The Fremont imbroglio caused an immense turmoil throughout the Union. In the border slave states, just as Lincoln predicted, Fremont's proclamation dealt a heavy blow to Unionist sentiment. That foolish proclamation, Joshua Speed promptly warned the president from Kentucky, will crush out any vestige of a Union party in the state. I'm now fully satisfied, he wrote a few days later, that we could stand several defeats like that at Bull's Run better than we can this foolish act of a military popinjay. Robert Anderson, now in command of the Department of Kentucky, warned that if the proclamation isn't immediately disavowed and annulled, Kentucky will be lost to the Union. Fremont's decree came at the worst possible time, when the legislature was about to abandon the policy of neutrality for Kentucky. The legislature would not budge until the proclamation was modified, and there was danger that Union volunteers in Kentucky would desert to the Confederacy. By overruling the most offensive parts of Fremont's edict, Lincoln save the state for the Union. As one Kentucky Unionist wrote, the president handled that matter with an honesty of purpose and a good sense that I have never seen surpassed. In the North, the reaction was exactly the opposite. Fremont's order aroused a public that was already tired of war and demanded decisive steps to end it. All the major newspapers approved it, not merely the staunchly Republican journals like the New York Tribune, the New York Times, and the Chicago Tribune, but also independent conservative papers like Washington's National Intelligencer and the Democratic Boston Post and Chicago Times. Even a cautious conservative like Browning wrote the president, Fremont's proclamation was necessary and will do good. It has the full approval of all loyal citizens of the West and the Northwest. From Iowa came a report that failure to sustain Fremont was causing extreme dissatisfaction and would end volunteering in the Northwest. It would have been difficult to have devised a plan to more effectually dispirit the people of this section than your order, a Wisconsin voter wrote the president. My own indignation is too deep for words, raged Horace White of the Chicago Tribune. Our president has broken his own neck if he has not destroyed his country. Benjamin Wade sneered that Lincoln's conduct was all that could be expected of one born of poor white trash and educated in a slave state. Ironically, Wade added, I shall expect to find in his annual message a recommendation to Congress to give each rebel who shall serve during the war 160 acres of land. Even Herndon, Lincoln's own law partner, thought the president had behaved shamefully. Does he suppose he can crush, squelch out this huge rebellion by pop guns filled with rose water? He jibed. He ought to hang somebody and get up a name for will or decision, for character. Let him hang some child or woman if he hasn't the courage to hang a man. Sorely beset, Lincoln laid out his reasons for overruling Fremont's proclamation in a long, careful letter to Browning. If the general's order had been allowed to stand, he explained, Kentucky would probably have seceded. I think to lose Kentucky is nearly the same as to lose the whole game, he went on. Kentucky gone, we cannot hold Missouri, nor, as I think, Maryland. These all against us, and the job on our hands is too large for us. We would as well consent to separation at once, including the surrender of this capital. He also offered an even more cogent reason, which he knew would appeal to men like Browning, who loved the Constitution and respected the rule of law. General Fremont's proclamation as to confiscation of property and the liberation of slaves is purely political, he wrote, and not within the range of military law or necessity. It was, in fact, simply dictatorship, because it assumed that the general may do anything he pleases. Far from saving the government, such reckless action meant the surrender of the government. Can it be pretended that it's any longer the government of the United States? Any government of constitution and laws wherein a general or a president may make permanent rules of property by proclamation? As indisputable evidence of Fremont's military incompetence and fiscal extravagance surfaced, support for the general waned, and criticism of the slow pace of the war effort focused on General McClellan, who only in July had been hailed as the defender of Washington and the savior of his country. At first, everybody admired the 34-year-old general. Handsome, with blue eyes and reddish-brown hair, he gave an impression of strength and vigor. He has brains, Browning thought. Looks as if he ought to have courage, and I think is altogether more than an ordinary man. Everybody else thought so, too. By some strange operation of magic, the young general wrote his wife, I seem to have become the power of the land. When he visited the Senate, the members vied to shake his hand. They give me my way in everything, full swing and unbounded confidence. There was only admiration for the way McClellan reorganized the forces around Washington. A skilled engineer, he developed a ring of fortifications to protect the city from surprise attacks. Replacing the useless 90-day soldiers who'd formed McDowell's force, most of their terms were about to expire, with 3-year volunteers, he began rigorously training his men and kept a close eye on them as they performed close-order drills, did target practice, and engaged in practice maneuvers. Dashing about on a magnificent horse, he seemed omnipresent, and no detail of his soldiers' life was too small to escape his notice. The men under his command, after August 15th, called the Army of the Potomac, loved him as they loved no other commander throughout the war. Along with his other talents, McClellan had an excellent sense of public relations, and he made a practice of inviting the President, the Secretary of War, other members of the cabinet, and senators to be present when he staged a review of the troops. The contrast between the general and his commander-in-chief as they rode down the lines struck some observers as ludicrous. McClellan was superb in full-dress uniform, while Lincoln, wearing his customary stovepipe hat, looked, according to one observer, like a scarecrow on horseback. Though amused, the soldiers were in good spirits and they gave resounding cheers to a president who hadn't received much applause in recent months. But by fall, McClellan's honeymoon ended. Critics began to complain that he wasn't taking advantage of the fine weather to launch an offensive against the Confederates, still lodged at Manassas. Horace Greeley again demanded that the army march on toward Richmond. Senator Chandler, originally one of McClellan's strongest backers, lost faith in the general. He lamented that Fremont's operations were bad enough in all conscience, but as compared with McClellan's, they were splendid. And he blamed the general's failure on a timid, vacillating, and inefficient administration. Wade was even more intemperate, simultaneously denouncing Old Abe and General McClellan. He raged that the general was stripping the West of men and putting them in the Army of the Potomac, so that Mr. Lincoln and his cabinet may breathe freely and eat their dinners in peace, and that Mrs. Lincoln may, without interruption, pursue her French and dancing. Abetted by Senator Trumbull, Wade and Chandler began worrying Lincoln into forcing McClellan to fight. Wade went so far as to say that he preferred an unsuccessful battle to further delay, because a defeat could be easily repaired by the swarming recruits. These critics were so persistent and vehement in their campaign against McClellan that John Hay labeled them Jacobins, after the most extreme radicals of the French Revolution, and the name stuck. Lincoln told the general not to fight until he was ready, but he felt obliged to warn him that Wade voiced a widely held feeling of impatience, which he said was a reality that had to be taken into account. McClellan listened, but evidently he did not hear. On October 21st, McClellan's critics were further infuriated when, after long inaction, an element of his army ventured across the Potomac at Ball's Bluff, or Leesburg, ran into fierce Confederate opposition, and was thrown back with heavy losses. Colonel Edward D. Baker, Lincoln's longtime friend and a senator from Oregon, was killed. The Lincolns were devastated by the news and received no White House visitors the next day. In Congress, grief over the fallen senator exploded into wrath at McClellan for having allowed such an ill-planned, poorly supported expedition. lawmakers began to harbor a growing suspicion that not merely Baker's superior officer, Charles P. Stone, but McClellan himself might be disloyal to the Union. McClellan defended himself by telling his congressional critics that he was hamstrung by the aged and nearly senile General Scott. They then descended on the White House to nag Lincoln into removing General Scott. And on November 1st, with a heavy heart, the president accepted Scott's offer to retire, which had often been tendered. In a statement praising Scott's long and brilliant career, Lincoln expressed the country's gratitude for his faithful devotion to the Constitution, the Union, and the flag when assailed by parricidal rebellion. That left McClellan in charge, and Lincoln designated him to command the whole Army of the United States. He was now in charge not merely of the Army of the Potomac, but of Don Carlos Buell's Army of the Ohio, which was preparing for a push into Tennessee, and Henry W. Halleck's Army of the Missouri, which was to move down the Mississippi River. In giving these increased responsibilities to McClellan, Lincoln said, "Draw on me for all the sense I have, and all the information. In addition to your present command, the supreme command of the army will entail a vast labor upon you." Quietly, McClellan responded, "I can do it all." But the general still failed to launch a campaign, and his relations with both the president and the Congress rapidly deteriorated. After his first few weeks in Washington, he concluded that the president is an idiot, but he rarely expressed his opinion until after he was placed in command of all the armies. Now he began consorting with Democratic politicians, and he wrote freely to his wife that Lincoln was nothing more than a well-meaning baboon, while Seward was a meddling, officious, incompetent little puppy, Welles was a garrulous old woman, Bates an old fool, and Cameron a rascal. He grew weary of the president's constant visits to his headquarters to read the latest military dispatches and discuss projected campaigns. General Samuel P. Heintzelman was present on one such occasion when Lincoln pored over the map of Virginia, making strategic suggestions which McClellan obviously thought absurd, but which he pretended to listen to deferentially. After the president left, McClellan turned to his subordinate and laughed, "Isn't he a rare bird?" Even more taxing were Lincoln's late-night visits to McClellan's house to discuss strategy, and the general decided to put an end to them. On the evening of November 13th, when Lincoln and Seward, accompanied by John Hay, called on McClellan, he was out, and they decided to stay until he returned. After about an hour, he came in and, paying no attention to the porter who told him the president was waiting, went straight upstairs. After another half hour, the guests sent up a message that they were still waiting, only to receive the cool message that the general had gone to bed. Hay thought the president should feel greatly offended, but Lincoln said, "It was better at this time not to be making points of etiquette and personal dignity." He paid no more visits to McClellan's house. Though Lincoln said that he was willing to hold McClellan's horse if he'd win a victory, he was growing disenchanted with his general-in-chief. In his December message to Congress, after expressing a hope that the country would support McClellan's exertions, he added a backhanded compliment. "It's been said that one bad general is better than two good ones, and the saying is true if taken to mean that an army is better directed by a single mind, though inferior, than by two superior ones at variance." congressmen could afford to be less guarded in their language. Senator Chandler bluntly told Lincoln that if McClellan allowed his huge army to go into winter quarters without fighting a battle, he was in favor of sending for Jeff Davis at once. Lincoln's first State of the Union message, which a clerk read to Congress on December 3, 1861, was a perfunctory document. Cobbling together reports from the various heads of departments, the president made a few interesting recommendations, such as creating a Department of Agriculture, which Congress established the next year. He also urged the recognition of the two black republics of Haiti and Liberia, something inconceivable under previous pro-Southern administrations. It closed with an oddly incongruous disquisition on the relationship between capital and labor in a free society, and with the assurance that the struggle in which the Union was engaged was not altogether for today. It is for a vast future also. One reason the message was so uncommunicative was that the United States was nearing a diplomatic crisis with Great Britain over the Trent affair, which couldn't be discussed publicly. The president could have summarized the facts succinctly. In October, James M. Mason of Virginia and John Slidell of Louisiana named ministers plenipotentiary to represent the Confederacy in Great Britain and France, escaped through the blockade to Cuba. There they boarded the British mail packet Trent. Without orders from Washington, Captain Charles Wilkes, who commanded the USS San Jacinto, stopped and searched the vessel and removed the Confederate envoys, who were eventually imprisoned in Fort Warren in Boston Harbor. Overwhelming jubilation greeted Wilkes's act in the North, but abroad it was viewed as a blatant violation of international law and an insult to the British flag. Lincoln had no advance knowledge of Wilkes's act. In general, the president had little to do with foreign affairs. With no knowledge of diplomacy and no personal acquaintances or correspondence abroad, he willingly entrusted foreign policy to his Secretary of State. The only interest he showed in selecting American diplomatic representatives was to make sure that various claims for patronage were honored. He rewarded Judd's services by making him minister to Prussia and showed his gratitude to Carl Schurz by naming him to the court at Madrid, where the German-born former revolutionary met with a chilly reception. Cassius M. Clay was appointed minister to Russia, less perhaps as a reward than as a means for getting the troublemaker out of the country. But generally, Lincoln accepted Seward's recommendations without question. When Charles Francis Adams, Seward's choice for minister to the Court of St. James's, came to the White House, Lincoln received his thanks for the appointment coolly. "Very kind of you to say so, Mr. Adams, but you're not my choice. You're Seward's man." Then, turning to the Secretary of State, the President said, in almost the same breath, "Well, Seward, I've settled the Chicago Post Office." Seward's bellicose memorandum of April 1, 1861, forced the President to take a more active interest in foreign policy, which increased when he read a warlike dispatch Seward proposed to send to Adams in May. Angered by the decision of the European powers to recognize the Confederates as belligerents, an entirely proper step, and one in conformity with the actions of the Lincoln administration in blockading rather than closing Southern ports, Seward blustered that British intervention in the American conflict would mean that, we from that hour shall cease to be friends and become once more, as we have twice before been forced to be, enemies of Great Britain." Troubled, the President called on Charles Sumner, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, for advice. With Sumner's enthusiastic approval, he excised the more offensive statements in Seward's dispatch and then directed that the revised document was for Adams's information only, not to be read or presented at the British Foreign Office. From that time, Lincoln consulted Sumner on all major questions relating to foreign policy. The two men formed an odd couple. Good-looking, Harvard-trained, and world-traveled, Sumner was the exact opposite of the homely, self-educated president. With a decade's experience in the Senate, Sumner regarded the untried Lincoln as honest but inexperienced, a compulsive worker, proud of his prompt and efficient attention to his official duties. The senator thought Lincoln's habits of business irregular and felt that the president didn't see at once the just proportions of things and allowed himself to be too much occupied by details. Sumner was proud of the purity of his diction, and he was pained when the president called secession rebellion sugar-coated, or said that the Confederates turned tail and ran. Lacking a sense of humor, he found conversation with Lincoln a constant puzzle. Even though the president tried to be solemn and took his feet down from the desk when Sumner entered his office. But these two radically different men came to respect and ultimately to like each other. Lincoln knew the senator was incorruptible, if often irritating. Sumner found that the president wanted to do right and to save the country. Lincoln turned so frequently to the senator for advice on foreign policy that Seward grumbled that there were now too many secretaries of state in Washington. In the Trent affair, Lincoln needed all the advice he could get. His initial reaction to the capture of Mason and Slidell was one of pleasure. At a time when Union victories were few, here, at last, was a success. Every member of the cabinet shared this view except Montgomery Blair, who immediately warned that the captives must be released. After the initial applause for Wilkes's bold act died down, thoughtful public opinion came around to Blair's assessment. To remove the Confederate diplomats from a neutral vessel was a clear violation of international law, and it contradicted the long-established American opposition to search and seizure on the high seas. Apart from legalities, Wilkes's boarding and search of the British mail packet had to be disavowed because it was an insult that no government in London could tolerate. Greatly preoccupied with other matters, Lincoln didn't recognize the seriousness of the Trent crisis until Sumner returned to Washington in late November. A regular correspondent of John Bright and Richard Cobden, the great British liberal leaders, Sumner brought news of the immense anti-American excitement in Great Britain because of Mason and Slidell, and he had a letter from the Duchess of Argyll, whose husband was in Lord Palmerston's cabinet, calling the seizure of the two envoys the maddest act that ever was done. And unless the United States government intended to force us to war, utterly inconceivable. Moved and astonished by these reports, Lincoln began to meet almost daily with the senator to assess the latest news and consider the danger that this disagreement with the British might drift into conflict. "There'll be no war unless England is bent upon having one," the president assured the senator. vexed that European governments misunderstood the pacific temper of his foreign policy, he offered to ignore bureaucratic protocol and talk face to face with Lord Lyons, the British minister. "If I could see Lord Lyons," he told Sumner rather wistfully, "I could show him in 5 minutes that I'm heartily for peace." Sumner warned of the impropriety of such a step, but, encouraged by John Bright, asked the president to think of submitting the issue with Great Britain to arbitration, either by the King of Prussia or by a group of learned publicists. Seizing upon Sumner's idea, Lincoln began drafting such a proposal. He was convinced, he told Browning, that the question was easily susceptible of a peaceful solution if England was at all disposed to act justly with us. But from all sides, the president received warnings that there was no time for arbitration. Thurlow Weed, who was working in behalf of the Union cause abroad, told of steps the British government was taking toward war. 8,000 soldiers were being sent to protect Canada, and an embargo on the shipment of saltpeter and other war materials to the United States was in place. From France, Minister Dayton reported that the government of Napoleon III would stand by the British in this crisis. When Lord Lyons, on December 23rd, presented the formal British demands for the release of Mason and Slidell, and for an apology from the United States government, they were hardly a surprise. Informally, the British minister also let Seward know that unless a satisfactory answer was received within 7 days, he had instructions to close the legation and leave Washington. With that deadline in mind, Lincoln summoned a cabinet meeting on Christmas Day, to which Sumner was invited in order to read the most recent letters he'd received from Bright and Cobden urging the release of the Confederate diplomats. All realized that the decision they made on this historic occasion would determine probably the existence of the nation. It was essential, everybody agreed, to avoid war with Great Britain. And the president said he had to avoid the folly of having two wars on his hands at a time. Seward, who'd finally awakened to the gravity of the crisis, read a paper he was preparing that would explain how Captain Wilkes had violated international law and why, therefore, Mason and Slidell must be released. The argument was hard for the other cabinet members, except Blair, to swallow. Chase said it was gall and wormwood to him. Even the president resisted giving up the envoys, though he realized that they'd become white elephants. The meeting ended without agreement on anything more than that they must meet again the next day. After the others left, the president said, "Governor Seward, you'll go on, of course, preparing your answer, which will state the reasons why they ought to be given up. Now I have a mind to try my hand at stating the reasons why they ought not to be given up. We'll compare the points on each side." By evening, the president gave up on his self-appointed task, and he told Browning that there would be no war with England. The next day, when the cabinet reassembled, Seward read his final version of the reply he intended to give to Lord Lyons, and it was endorsed with some expressions of regret, but without dissent. After the meeting adjourned, the secretary reminded the president, "You thought you might frame an argument for the other side." "I found I couldn't make an argument that would satisfy my own mind," Lincoln replied with a smile, "and that proved to me your ground was the right one." With that decision, the gravest threat that the American Civil War would become an international conflict was removed. Lincoln's domestic crises in the winter of 1861 and 62 were almost as severe. Frustrated over the failure of Union armies to advance, and angry over mounting expenses, Congress moved rapidly to take charge. On the day the session opened, even before the president's message was heard, Trumbull gave notice that he'd introduce a bill for the confiscation of the land and slaves of all persons who were in arms against the United States or who aided or abetted the rebellion. The Illinois senator, once Lincoln's close political ally, was convinced that the president lacked the will necessary in this great emergency, and believed that Congress must take steps to bring the war to a quick end. Other congressmen tried to move the stalled war effort along through investigating committees, a device that had proved very effective to Republicans in undermining the Buchanan administration. A House committee headed by John F. Potter of Wisconsin had been working all summer to ferret out rebel sympathizers still holding jobs in the government departments, and it performed a needed service in bringing about dismissals and resignations. The House Judiciary Committee, in its eagerness to investigate alleged telegraphic censorship of the press, came perilously close to investigating the White House itself. Despite precautions for security, the New York Herald received an advance copy of the president's State of the Union message and published excerpts before members of Congress heard it. The Herald's source proved to be Henry Wyckoff, an unsavory adventurer whom the paper had planted in Washington as its secret reporter. Cosmopolitan and flashy, Wyckoff had made a great impression on Mary Lincoln, and he became an intimate in the White House. When the rival New York Tribune charged that Mrs. Lincoln had given Wyckoff access to her husband's message, the House Judiciary Committee decided to investigate. The decision was an easy one, because almost nobody in the Capitol liked Mary Lincoln. Thinking her a renegade to the Southern cause, the dowagers who dominated Washington society condemned everything that she did. The smaller contingent of Northern women in the national capital, knowing that Mary Lincoln came from a Southern state and that some of her brothers had joined the Confederate Army, suspected her loyalty to the Union. Murat Halstead of the Cincinnati Commercial sneered that she was a fool, the laughing stock of the town, her vulgarity only the more conspicuous in consequence of her fine carriage and horses and servants in livery and fine dresses and her damnable airs. The New York sophisticate John Bigelow ridiculed her pretensions to speak French and claimed that when asked if she could use the language, she replied, "Très peu." Consequently, there was much lip-smacking in Washington over the titillating possibilities of this gossip about Mrs. Lincoln and Chevalier Wyckoff. There was, it proved, less to the story than met the eye. Wyckoff, subpoenaed by the committee, refused to disclose his source and was incarcerated overnight. The next day, he agreed to testify, and as the committee members listened avidly, he revealed that he'd received a copy of the president's message not from Mrs. Lincoln, but from John Watt, the head White House gardener. The committee chewed over this information for several days before it decided to drop the investigation. More significant were the activities of a special committee named in July to look into allegations of fraud and mismanagement in government contracts. Headed by Charles H. Van Wyck of New York, this committee was instrumental in exposing some of the scandals of the Fremont regime in Missouri. much of its work justifiably centered on the War Department, a model of maladministration and waste. There was, of course, no question of the presidents being involved in any of the shady deals that were making fortunes for manufacturers of shoddy goods. Lincoln was so punctilious that he refused to permit the army butcher to supply the White House with the choicest cuts of steak when he slaughtered cattle on the grounds of the Washington Monument. Told that this was a matter of little importance, he replied, "My observation is that frequently the most insignificant matters the foundation for the worst scandal." Nor was Simon Cameron believed to be personally venal, but he was the head of a corrupt department and was responsible for its actions. Lincoln didn't need a congressional investigation to tell him that the War Department was badly run. Cameron, he remarked confidentially to Nicolay, was utterly ignorant, selfish, and openly discourteous to the president, obnoxious to the country, and incapable of either organizing details or conceiving and advising general plans. If he had any doubts, his mail offered a chorus of objections to the Secretary of War. "Cameron ought to resign," Gustav Corner had warned Senator Trumbull as early as July 24th. "The people have no confidence in him at all. He's suspected of every sort of peculation. Lincoln must have an honest man as war minister." "It's universally believed that Cameron's a thief," a New Yorker wrote the president, detailing how the War Department sold to the soldiers half-cotton blankets weighing less than 5 pounds for the same price as regulation all-wool blankets weighing 10 or 11 pounds. The cautious Browning alerted Lincoln that his Secretary of War, whether justly or not, has lost, or rather failed to secure, the confidence of the country and should be removed. A New York banker, James A. Hamilton, told the president that if he replaced Cameron, the hard-pressed Treasury Department could immediately raise the $100 million it needed to borrow. Even though Lincoln hadn't wanted Cameron in his cabinet initially, he hesitated to fire him and tried to get rid of the secretary by dropping hints. "It might be unfair to replace Cameron now," he whispered to Schuyler Colfax, a friend of the secretary, but he added, "If it were an open question and to be settled de novo, he could see many advantages in having another person in the War Department." He let it be known that he had a great desire to turn the War Department over to Joseph Holt, who'd capably served as Secretary of War in the last days of the Buchanan administration. But Cameron was impervious to suggestion and stayed on. As pressure for his resignation grew, the secretary took a daring gamble. Asked, as were the other members of the cabinet, to prepare a report on the activities of his department to be submitted to Congress, along with the president's annual State of the Union message, he remembered how enthusiastically anti-slavery men had greeted Fremont's Edict of Emancipation in Missouri, and decided to include in his report an announcement that it is clearly a right of the government to arm slaves and employ their service against the rebels. He then sent the document out to newspapers in the principal cities without informing the president. Lincoln immediately ordered the report recalled and Cameron's remarks concerning slaves expurgated. After that, it was simply a matter of time before Cameron left the cabinet. The president could put up with incapacity and sloth in his administration, but he wouldn't allow Fremont or Cameron to set government policy on slavery. On January 11, 1862, Lincoln curtly notified Cameron that he could now gratify his desire for a change of position by nominating him as minister to Russia. Cameron had no such desire, and he broke into tears when Secretary Chase gave him Lincoln's letter, which he said was a personal affront, which meant personal as well as political destruction. To save Cameron's feelings, the president withdrew his letter so that Cameron could submit his resignation. Lincoln then wrote another letter, this time expressing his affectionate esteem and praising Cameron's ability, patriotism, and fidelity to public trust. Lincoln's troubles with Cameron didn't end with his resignation. To the considerable discomfort of the president, the House Committee on Contracts continued to investigate malfeasance in the War Department with such vigor that Lincoln accused one of the most prominent members, Representative Henry L. Dawes, of having done more to break down the administration than any other man in the country. Acting on the committee's recommendation, the full House, in April, voted to censure the former secretary for actions highly injurious to the public service. At this point, Lincoln had to intervene. Assuring the Congress that letting contracts without bids, dispersing public monies without authorization, and other irregularities were actions taken of necessity in the early days of the war, he explained that Cameron, although he fully approved the proceedings, was not primarily to blame for them. Not only the president, but all the other heads of departments were at least equally responsible. Not wishing to bring down the entire government, the investigators let the subject die. Investigations of military affairs fell to the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War, set up at the beginning of this session of Congress, and they continued throughout the conflict. The original purpose of the committee was to look into the disaster at Ball's Bluff, but its scope was soon expanded to cover military operations throughout the country. It concentrated mainly on the activities, or the lack of activities, of the Army of the Potomac. Benjamin F. Wade, a severe critic of both Lincoln and McClellan, was chairman, and he had the enthusiastic collaboration of Zachariah Chandler. The three House Republicans on the committee, George W. Julian of Indiana, John Covode of Pennsylvania, and Daniel Gooch of Massachusetts, also sought to prod the general and the president into prosecuting the war more vigorously. The two Democratic members, Andrew Johnson, the sole senator from the southern states who remained in Congress, and Moses Odell, a New Yorker, played lesser roles. Lincoln viewed the creation of the Committee on the Conduct of the War with some anxiety, fearing that it might turn into an engine of agitation against the administration. When Wade and Chandler learned of his objections, they rushed to the White House to assure the president that their purpose was to aid, not to embarrass, the chief executive. Probably neither party believed the promise, but a surface harmony was maintained. Lincoln had his first meeting with the committee on December 31st and was relieved to find the congressman in a perfectly good mood. Both the committee and the president were eager to learn McClellan's plans. The general was reticent even with Lincoln. He declined to outline the campaign he proposed, but dropped a cryptic hint that he no longer thought of advancing against the Confederate army at Manassas and had his mind actively turned towards another plan of campaign, not at all anticipated by the enemy, nor by many of our own people. The committee didn't get even this much from him. He was called to testify, but shortly before Christmas he fell ill with typhoid fever. For 3 weeks he was unable to do any serious work, much less to appear before the committee. He had no second in command, no council of officers to whom he had entrusted his plan for the coming campaign. As frustrated as the president, the committee began taking testimony from anti-McClellan witnesses, and it became a powerful engine of criticism, not merely of the general, but of his commander-in-chief. Chapter 12. The Bottom is Out of the Tub. The president is an excellent man, and in the main, wise, Attorney General Bates recorded in his final diary entry of 1861. But he lacks will and purpose, and I greatly fear he hasn't the power to command. That judgment, by one of the most cautious and conservative members of the Lincoln administration, represented a widely held opinion. Nearly everybody thought the president was honest and well-meaning, and almost everyone who met him liked him. Ralph Waldo Emerson, for instance, who visited the White House with Senator Sumner in January 1862, wasn't put off by Lincoln's homely appearance and his awkward movements and gestures. He found the president a frank, sincere, well-meaning man with a lawyer's habit of mind. Correct enough, not vulgar, as described, but with a sort of boyish cheerfulness. But few thought he was up to his job. He seemed unable to make things go right. With the surrender of Mason and Slidell, the United States suffered a humiliating, if necessary, reverse in foreign affairs. Huge armies, raised at immense expense, lay idle in winter quarters. As the costs of the war mounted, the Treasury lived on credit, and banks throughout the country had to suspend specie payments. In the Northwest, farmers were suffering as laborers went off to the army, and there was no market for farm produce because the Mississippi River was closed. The people are being bled, and as they believe, to no purpose, and will not long submit to it, warned one Illinois Cassandra. So desperate did things look in early January that Lincoln, for the first time, thought that the Confederates might be successful, and he spoke of the bare possibility of our being two nations. At the heart of the problems was the failure of the armies to advance and win victories. Lincoln's general-in-chief was still recovering from typhoid fever and unable to work. When the Committee on the Conduct of the War met with the president on January 6th, its members were appalled to learn that neither he nor anybody else knew McClellan's plans. Lincoln told the congressman that he didn't think he had any right to know, but that, as he wasn't a military man, it was his duty to defer to General McClellan. As pressure grew for action, and McClellan was still incapacitated, the president tried to exercise the functions of the general-in-chief himself. He knew that McClellan had talked of a joint movement on the part of the armies west of the Appalachians to be coordinated with an advance by the Army of the Potomac, and he wired Buell and Halleck to go ahead, only to learn that they knew nothing about the plan. Directing the two generals to get in communication and concert at once, he urged Halleck to make a real or feigned attack on Columbus in western Kentucky, while Buell advanced on Bowling Green in the south-central part of that state. Lincoln hoped that Buell would eventually push into eastern Tennessee, where the Union Army could cut the major east-west rail line of the Confederacy, the great artery of the enemy's communication. More important, it could liberate thousands of strongly Unionist inhabitants of eastern Tennessee, whom the president considered the most valuable stake we have in the South. Both generals failed him. Lincoln was still too insecure to play the role of military commander. He offered views he hoped would be respectfully considered rather than orders, and the generals felt free to dispute or ignore them. Since the roads into eastern Tennessee were very bad in winter, Buell told the president he'd prefer to go to Nashville, which, as Lincoln had pointed out, had no strategic value. Halleck responded that Buell's plans didn't make much military sense. Anyway, he couldn't spare troops from his widely scattered command for an attack on Columbus. Sadly, the president sent the correspondence over to the War Department with the endorsement, "It's exceedingly discouraging. As everywhere else, nothing can be done." With a growing sense of desperation, Lincoln began to think of leading one of the armies into battle himself. After all, the Constitution made him commander-in-chief. He borrowed from the Library of Congress Henry W. Halleck's Elements of Military Art and Science, a standard text, and several other books on military strategy, and began studying them. He conferred frequently with military commanders in the vicinity of Washington, and he assiduously read the reports from others who were in the field. At times, he convinced himself that he could do a better job. But he knew he was no military man, and that this was all fantasy that helped him escape his real problems. On January 10th, visiting Quartermaster General Montgomery C. Meigs, he summed up the difficulties he faced. "The people are impatient. Chase has no money, and he tells me he can raise no more. The general of the army has typhoid fever. The bottom is out of the tub. What shall I do?" he asked. Meigs advised him to call on some of the senior division commanders of the Army of the Potomac for advice. That evening, Lincoln invited General McDowell and General William B. Franklin to the White House, where they met with him, Seward, Chase, and Assistant Secretary of War Peter Watson. To this informal council of war, the president poured out his problems. He must talk to somebody, he said, because something had to be done. If General McClellan was not going to use the Army of the Potomac, the president continued, he would like to borrow it, provided he could see how it could be made to do something. The generals gave different advice. McDowell urged another forward movement against Manassas, the scene of his defeat, while Franklin, who knew something of McClellan's wishes, talked of moving the army down the Potomac to the York River so as to advance on Richmond from the east. The president asked the two generals to learn more about the actual state of the army and to come back the next day. When the informal council of war reassembled, the commanders agreed that a move on Manassas was the best operation at this time. But Meigs and Montgomery Blair, who'd joined the group, vigorously opposed this strategy because it would certainly lead to another Bull Run. Unsure how to resolve the conflict, Lincoln again adjourned the meeting. On January 13th, McClellan rose from his sickbed to join in the discussion. Clearly regarding these meetings as a conspiracy against him, the general-in-chief was sullen and uncommunicative. When Lincoln again rehearsed the urgent reasons for his actions and asked what could be done, McClellan replied scornfully that the case was so clear a blind man could see it. and then diverted the conversation to his perpetual fear that the Confederate forces outnumbered his own. Eventually, Chase asked him directly what he intended to do with his army and when he intended to move. The general sat silent. When Meigs whispered to him that the president had a right to know his intentions, McClellan responded in a voice inaudible to the rest of the group, "If I tell him my plans, they'll be in the New York Herald tomorrow morning. He can't keep a secret." After further urging, he said that he was very unwilling to develop his plans, because he believed that in military matters, the fewer persons who knew them, the better, but that he would tell them if he was ordered to do so. All that Lincoln could get from him was a pledge that he did have a specific time in mind for an advance, though he was unwilling to divulge it. With that, the president declared he was satisfied. He was not, in fact, at all satisfied. His unhappiness grew when he discovered a few days after these meetings that a planned expedition to seize the mouth of the Mississippi River would be indefinitely delayed because Army authorities had failed to prepare the necessary beds, or racks, for the mortars the ships were to carry. Exasperated, he told Gustavus Fox that he now believed he must take these army matters into his own hands.
This ends Disc 18.